Well, good morning and good evening, EPL State of Mind listeners. Hold on to your berets, your bonnets, your visors, your deer seekers, your garrison caps, or whatever the hell type of hat you are currently wearing, because we have a heater of an episode for you this week. Not only will my personal blood pressure reach new heights for a second time in 3 days, but we will go over this week's Champions League draw with a bit of History 101 class for all of you in honor of the tournament's new format. We will also dig into this week's comeback of the century at Goodison Park, Arsenal's robbery versus Brighton, and most importantly, reflect on the bald versus bald, the double Dutch match, the classic Northwest Derby, or the Merseyside Derby, whatever you were calling the Man U versus Liverpool game this weekend. We will have it all here, and we will let Sean off his leash completely for this week's version of what would I definitely still say to Erik ten Hag's face if he were in fact actually in front of me right now. So I am excited, Sean. So why don't we get right into it? How are you doing, my man?
Listen, I am fan-freaking-tastic. Liverpool undefeated, coming off a very nice win, like you said, that we'll get into a little bit later on. I definitely have some choice words for that bald fraud. My Dutch bald fraud is way better than yours. Just meaning Manchester United fans. But no, really excited about that. Very excited to get into that. And then obviously the big thing, the Champions League draw that we saw as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I believe the draw occurred Eastern Standard Time at noon over here on Wednesday. It was held in Monaco. I don't know if it's held there every year. I think it is, just because it's one of those fancy places that a lot of the higher ups like to go and enjoy. So that was held at noon on Wednesday. Obviously, many of us have only known and loved the previous Champions League format, which was group stages. But I believe that's also technically speaking here, because there has only been one type of Champions League format prior to this year's magnanimous change. To fully understand this, I think it is only proper if we take a little trip down history lane, and the time and reflection is among us. So now everyone, listeners out there, I just want everyone to close their eyes quickly and picture this very truthful story. The year is 1955, the location none other than Paris. Kyle, James, and Sean were walking, taking a slight stroll along the River Seine, and were pondering about the world of football and how we could possibly bring more joy to the world through the sport of foot. Obviously, just then, simultaneously, all three of us devilishly handsome-looking lads turned to each other with the same brilliant idea, an international tournament amongst the top-tier clubs. It was at this moment in 1995 in Paris that Kyle, myself, and Sean invented the European Cup. It gets better. It keeps going. The Champions League was founded in 1995 in Paris, and it was called the European Cup back then. And back then, we, the three of us, decided that the European Cup was to be comprised of only 16 teams, and the style of the tournament would be straight four rounds of single elimination knockout games. So you have a first round, a quarter round, a semifinals, and a finals. Obviously, this was fantastic. It blew up. James, Kyle, and Sean now live in half of the Louvre is ours. 5 years later, in 1960, everyone wanted in on the action, so we expanded it to the 32 teams that we typically would have known. Same format, single elimination, so we just added additional round. We grew old of this format relatively quickly, and the trades and the partners and the clubs got relatively greedy for more money, and the threats of a Super League started even back then. So obviously, quick on our feet, we decided to make the change in 1992 to the tournament and rebrand it as the Champions League. And the format changed what we all grew up to know as 8 groups of 4 in a round robin home and away leg style group tournament into round of 16 knockouts, whereon we would continue until the victors reigned supreme. Flash forward to present day, for similar reasons, meaning financial burden or financial greed to the larger clubs again and the threat of a Super League. UEFA wanted to squash this one more time, so we decided to continue funding the big teams in the tournament by increasing this year's tournament size from 32 to 36, which enhances the duration of the tournament as well. And to go over the specifics of what changes between the our original Champions League in 1992 to now. Sean, why don't you kind of take from here and go over what the big differences are here this year?
Sure, absolutely. So obviously the increase of 4 teams, as you mentioned, But the group stage, as we know it, has been replaced with what's called the Swiss model. It's basically a league phase where each team plays 8 games, 4 home and 4 away. Now, some of the primary differences are that instead of being grouped with a specific batch of teams, everyone is graded or their performance is, it basically dictates the league standing, and you don't play the same teams where you played, you know, 2 games against 3 different clubs. Now you play 7 or 8 games against 8 different clubs. There's no repeats in that group stage. And what it brings to us, essentially, it brings the likelihood of bigger matchups happening, which we saw in this draw. I mean, there's some major matchups, you know, Liverpool and Madrid, Bayer Leverkusen and Arsenal, Inter Milan and Arsenal. There's some awesome, awesome games that we wouldn't have gotten probably until the knockout stages. So it brings us that piece of it. The other thing that's really exciting about it is that there is no safety net of the Europa League. Basically, how it works is teams that finish 1-8 automatically qualify into the round of 16. 9-24 play in a play-in round or knockout round, kind of like how the Europa League used to work before the knockout round stages. And then if you're below that 24 spot, you're from 25 to 36, as Kyle would say, you feathers, get out of my sight. You're done. Your season from a European perspective is over. There is no Europa League to drop down into. So that's really exciting. And like I said, it makes for a lot more games. Obviously, at the end of the day, there is some money piece of this. But I'm just curious kind of what you think about it and kind of your overall reaction to the draw as well.
Yeah. So one thing, if you guys haven't heard of like this whole process or the UEFA coefficient and stuff like that, or really get into the Champions League, I implore you to go to The Athletic's last podcast as well. They have a great rendition of the Champions League where they get into all this and stuff like that. And a lot of the opinions I agree with. You know, at first, I was skeptical about this, not only because Arsenal just finally got back into the Champions League and now we're changing it up to potentially something that creates more diversity and more challenges to advance. But, you know, I'm kind of looking forward to it now. I think the idea of placing first overall, or having the ability to place first overall in this phase one, the league phase, is actually really appealing to teams now. Like, it adds another potential season milestone / accomplishment. It adds more of a bit of like a check-in, right? So like you rate your team how you played that year on your position in the league, but now you can say, oh hey, I didn't go too far in the Champions League, but when we are doing the league phase, we were, you know, top 8, we were top 4. It adds a little bit more of a notch on your belt to do it. I think it also adds a little bit of longevity to the do or die feeling that we get. This was typical for like maybe the first 4 rounds, first 4 games of the previous group stage rendition, just because like Bayern Munich, they haven't lost a group stage in God knows how long. I think like in 30 games or something outrageous, where by like the 3rd or 4th game in the group stage, they're already qualified. And now we don't have that do or die feeling. So not playing a team twice that could potentially easily get you 6 points, and you know, you could slip up against a team any day in this tournament, it gives a little bit more longevity to that do or die feeling, I feel like, which is pretty cool. You're with the more diversification with kind of the different pots, I think we're less likely to have groups of death or easy way in. There will always be, I mean, you know, my run in was harder than your run in and their run in was easier than mine, but I think it's a little less obvious in this one. Mm-hmm. You kind of alluded to it. I think overall, this is, you know, just another way to give the richer teams more money, since there'll be more games, resulting in more ticket and commercial airtime revenue. This tournament's always been so critical and crucial to make it into from your domestic season, so you can get that prize money and a participation fee. So I think this only increases the need for that too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also just the other positive is that we get those games. All those games have meaning now. Like you were talking about specifically with Bayern, they played 4 games that mattered, and then they'd kind of play their B squad because they've already qualified top of their group into the next round. Now it has meaning. You know, every single match is important. Goal differential is important. So I'm sure City will be padding the score against teams like, for example, Slovan Bratislava and Sparta Prague. I can't imagine Even if you combine those two, like the old Czechoslovakian, I don't know if they, I love their chances against Man City. But yeah, I'm really excited for it. I was a little bit peeved in the first place when it first came out, kind of like yourself. I think we were all like, oh, this is just a money grab, but it is exciting. I think it'll make this, the preliminary phase of the tournament a lot more interesting. So I look forward to that. But just to kind of preview how the English Premier League teams' fixtures line up, like I said, for Man City, they play Inter Milan at home, Slovan Bratislava, Sparta Praha, Sporting, Feyenoord, which is where Arne Slot used to manage, Juve, PSG, and Club Brugge. I mean, for example, Inter Milan, PSG, and Juve, you might get one of those in a group of Man Cities, but you're not getting three of them where they're playing in that group stage. City always seems to also get the absolute joke of a draw. So I'm glad that that kept up, because just, you know, going down to the next line, Liverpool goes up against AC Milan at the San Siro, Bologna, RB Leipzig, Bayer Leverkusen, the team that I hate maybe more than life itself, Real Madrid, Girona, Lille, and PSV, which is a nice little, and that one's away, which is a nice little potential opportunity for revenge for Arne Slot. PSV did pip his Feyenoord team to the title last year in the Eredivisie, so he gets to go back to his home soil and maybe exact a little bit of revenge. But why don't you talk about the teams that were down in pot two?
Yeah, I want to emphasize again, Sean, you're right. And what you mentioned before is like some of the these matchups are huge and they're early on. You know, it kind of blends the old 1955 motto of potentially having a big game early on and like the 1992 upgrade to now be modernized, which I think will be fun. But of course, you know, pot number two was Arsenal. Just an honor to be here for the first ever Champions League phase. So really just happy to participate. But of course, we will have a tough competition as well. We first face off away at Atalanta for the Europa League winners. That's away. Then we have a home game, which I think is going to be awesome to watch, and that's versus PSG. Then we have Shakhtar at home as well. We then have, I'm calling it the Luigi and Jeff Medrano Bowl, as Arsenal faces Inter Milan away at San Siro again. We find out who's better this year, Sporting against Sporting CP. And then Monaco, Dynamo, and Girona as well away. So a couple really big names in there, a couple really good games. And then we finally turn to the last of the Premier League teams with Aston Villa making a return to European play. They don't have a bad draw overall. I think they probably have one of the easier ones at their squad. It has a lot of potential. Their first one is away at Young Boys. Then they host Bayern Munich home, Bologna, Club Brugge, Juventus, which is also considered the return of Douglas Luiz since they offloaded him this summer or sold him. You have RB Leipzig, you have Monaco, and finally they play Celtic away to round it off. So a lot of interesting games. There are some teams that overlap between our Premier League squads, between each one of our eight games. So it will be interesting to see how each Premier League team does against those competitors to do a little check on how we're doing in the Champions League. So that will be a lot of fun. And don't you worry, because the first game actually kicks off Tuesday, September 17th. So be ready. It is right around the corner. We are already in September.
Yeah. And the other thing, just like you were talking about before, it's kind of a measuring stick of where you're at as a club. Obviously for Arsenal, they have some tough games early. They play Spurs away. They play at the Etihad. So we'll be able to kind of measure those teams up against each other. But from a Liverpool standpoint, who, you know, doesn't run into City until I think November, they don't play Arsenal until late October, Newcastle, like some of the teams that'll be up at the top of the table. It's a really good opportunity to kind of see how well they stack up, because they look, you know, very promising now, but they run into AC Milan. They run into, you know, Bologna, Bayer Leverkusen. That's a good measuring stick of really where they're at as a squad.
Yeah, it's going to be, this is going to be thrown in the middle of like the thick of really getting out of the gate, you know, right. So a great point. It'll be very, very difficult. But Kyle, welcome back, sir. I know he's always burning that work oil. So Sean and I covered over the Champions League format, so we haven't missed much here. You came just in time for the segment number two, which is our weekend roundup as always. Real quick, before we pop into this, I'll throw you on the spot. With the new Champions League format, how are you excited for this new format with the league phase, or how are you feeling about this, Kyle?
I mean, I can see how the players are upset. I'm personally not. you correct me if I'm wrong, but it's more games, is it not?
Yep.
More soccer. Yep. I mean, I'm so in. It's my favorite tournament in the world. I got a tattoo of it on my shoulder. But, you know, for the players, I absolutely understand their complaints of more games is more tired legs. It's more chances for injury. You know, they're taking away the accolades from the original set list of games. And you got to think, I mean, talk 2012, 2013. Messi scored 93 calendar goals in a year. That's a record that, you know, will never get beaten. Unless they start changing the rules of the mandatory tournaments for top level teams, and you're going to start playing a lot more games, more chances. It's, you know, I think it takes away a little bit of the past, but it also is, you know, a brighter future. More football for us, more fans. I think it's great for the sport itself. But yeah, other than players, I really see no downside, no reason not to like this.
Yeah, great point. I mean, we'll talk about Haaland, you know, later on, of course, in Rapid Kicks again, but he's on pace for some crazy volume of goals just in the English Premier League.
88.
Yeah.
He's on pace for 88 goals, guys.
We've had three games. And like you said, he's going to have more games in the Champions League. And Sean mentioned before, too, when he's playing these third world teams in this tournament, he can pop in four in the first half and then pop down and sit down. And then he puts the calendar year goal record at jeopardy, which is fully deserved. My God, the guy's an animal. We'll talk about that later. But it's got a lot of potential. It does add more finances for everybody. I think we'll see a little bit more division, a little bit more of a gap in domestic league tables based off of prize money. But we'll really see if we can grow into that and see if there's something else. The sizes of the Europa League and the Conference League have also grown. So that's a good point for a lot of teams to potentially try to get in as well. But other than that, we had a crazy weekend. We're not going to start off with what gets my blood pumping right off the bat. I'm going to kind of settle into it. But one that obviously has a lot of Everton fans blood pumping. I've watched one of my friends quite literally sent a video of him throwing out his Everton jersey and sent that over. You gotta do a mental health check on your Everton fans. You have to. And Sean, why is that?
Well, dude, I just want to say we got to get that video out on social media ASAP. That's priceless. I'm assuming that was Blake.
No, that was actually Chase. He's in my other friend group. We're in another fantasy league. Blake, I think, has just stopped watching altogether.
Yeah, well, listen, that's understandable after this game. It's the game of the year. Candidate, we're in week three. It'll be up there. Adoni Iriola's men have started to get quite the reputation as the comeback kings. We saw it last year at Kenilworth Road when they were down 3-0 at halftime. And I think Antoine Semenyo scored a stoppage time winner in that one to win 4-3. To me, this one might be even more impressive. The fact that they went into Goodison Park, they really were dominated for 88% of the game. But they scored three goals in the match's final 10 minutes, including two in stoppage time, to vanquish the Toffees and push them down or keep them down into 20th place in the league table. To start from the positive side of things for Everton, which I'll do my best. Illiman Ndiaye looked phenomenal in this game. Kind of like we talked about with Morgan Rodgers the week before, where he just has the ability to take defenders on and dribble past them almost at ease. He was really good at that in this game and kind of helped spark a lot of the chances that Everton created. From an XG standpoint, where they're not typically known for being the best in terms of attacking generation, they generated 2.08. I thought Dominic Calvert-Lewin looked pretty good. He set up the first goal for Michael Keane, the center back, with a really nice finish for a center back.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
hats off to you. You struck the, you know, you hit the valves clean on that one. And then he also scored the second one as well to give him a 2-0 lead. But the catalyst for me is Luis Sinisterra. He came on around the 70-minute mark, where to that point, they had been pretty summarily outplayed. But once he kind of came on, he got the cherries ticking and they grew into the game. And you just kind of felt it almost around the same time that Ndiaye went off, actually, that Bournemouth really started taking over the game, creating lots of big time chances. They scored the first one in, I think, the 87th minute. And then it just was an absolute onslaught from there. They get the second one at the 92nd minute mark, and then the winner in, I think it was like the 96th minute of stoppage time. But Sinisterra set up the second goal and then scored the winner. So to me, he definitely deserves a hat tip. We talked about him coming over from Leeds last year in the winter window and not getting a ton of game time, but now with the departure of Solanke, he's going to be a crucial piece of their offense. And it's a good sign in this one. A really incredible comeback, though, overall.
I can't remember a game where it was that late to have three goals come back and actually physically to win the match. And hats off to Bournemouth, because they did not want to join. They were on pace to join the bottom six teams that have still yet to find a win. And that's, you know, Leicester, Crystal Palace, Ipswich, the Wanderers, the Wolves, right? Southampton, and of course, Everton not being able to did a little flip-flop there with Bournemouth. Not a great look. Still a lot of teams. Obviously, it's still really early. Everton kind of had a rough start last year and really found a lot of form towards the second half of the season with Sean Dyche. So hopefully they can turn those fears away quickly. But again, the relegation battle doesn't start for quite some time, but difficult one for sure.
Just one more point on that. I thought it was a lot of Everton's defenders just getting lazy in the end of the game. I mean, three goals that all came from deep crosses.
Yeah.
All of them. That's center back territory. You got to be able to stop that in the last couple minutes of the game. I mean, granted, you played the whole game, you're tired, but all of the goals are on crosses. They're not dicing you. They're not out dribbling you. They're just beating you in the air.
Yeah, you got to – you're up 2-0. A lot of the top-level teams at that point, they still have the fire to win and hold a clean sheet. That's the mentality, right, at that point?
Yeah, absolutely. It's inexcusable to kind of collapse in that fashion so quickly. But I just – sorry to cut you off, James. I just wanted to mention that Everton hasn't had a win in the month of August since August 17th of 2021.
Oof.
That's 11 matches in a row now without winning a game. And it's like, no wonder they're always in the relegation dogfight. You get out of the block so slow every year, you're playing catch up for the rest of the season.
Yep. Yep. And then you're obviously, you know, catching some stray point deductions here and there. So that just doesn't help throughout the longevity of the tournament.
That does not help.
But yeah, tough look for him. It's a good time for an international break for him, but another good time for a team that, you know, really struggled against a squad at their home, I guess away, would be Tottenham versus Newcastle. Obviously, the result was similar to the last couple trips the Spurs had as a loss, but overall, a large improvement for them. Tottenham lost to Newcastle at St. James's Park this weekend, 1-2. The XGs of this game was Newcastle 1.61 to Tottenham 1.3. Pretty even game overall. I would say that Spurs definitely looked like they had the upper hand in terms of possession, chances created, and really just control of the game. But the big thing for me here is Tottenham's lack of finishing and chance creation was evident, right? So a couple big stats for me was shots. Newcastle 9 to Spurs 20. Newcastle had 3 on target to Spurs 6. If you have 20 shots and only 6 are on target, the other 14 that you're doing, there's got to be something just not right. It's not the proper shot selection. You're not working the ball into the right areas. And, you know, 11 of these shots were from outside the box, 6 of which came from Pedro Porro. So you've got to really think here. Like, Pedro Porro was a very important player to the Spurs. He's very attack-minded for another right back in the league. But he's taken 6 shots all from outside the box, and none of them, I believe, were on target. You got to start thinking if that's the proper approach, or you got to start recycling the ball more. You know, having the most shots is great, but if none of them go in, there's no point. You know, you look at a lot of teams now, like Liverpool will start to work the ball around a little bit more, control possession to try to find the proper shot. Arsenal don't force any shots, right? They'll dribble into the box before taking 5 shots from outside. Something I don't necessarily like, but it is what it is. You know, you got to look at another thing for the Spurs. They had 12 corners. None looked remotely dangerous, and less than half of them, I believe, looked to be direct, meaning that they took short corners instead, playing it outside the box, the top of the 18, to guess who, Pedro Porro or James Maddison. This is probably because, you know, Spurs don't have a super tall team. They have a good 6-foot roster, but you're also, with Solanke being gone, you're missing a 6-foot, I think he's 6'3", 6'4", who's really gifted in the air. So obviously, I think they took that and try to work it around a little bit more. On the positive side for Spurs, even though they were handed a major blow with Mickey van de Ven being ruled out for not being 100% with a potential knee injury before the game, Radu Dragusin, who also, I don't know if we mentioned it multiple times, fucking sick last name. It just sounds like you're part dragon. So Ragu had actually his first start of the season. I think it was his third or fourth start for Spurs. And he played really well alongside Romero, who is he's one of the best center backs in the league. So that's a positive side to see, even though with, I think, your second best center back out, you had the $32 million, I think, signing that you took in January last year come in and play very well. As far as Newcastle goes, I don't think anything really special here to mention. My main man, Isak, got back on the scoring sheet with a game-winning tap-in, super easy. He had a really, really close worldie of a chip over Vicario in the first half that was only denied by the crossbars, like bottom inch. Overall, though, I think they took the pressure from Spurs really well and were able to get two goals against the run of play and take home, I think, the third straight home victory against Spurs for them. Anthony Gordon continues to be an issue down the left side, as he always will. But for me, the player to highlight here is Livramento. He's 21 years old. He has taken the starting position of right back fully away from Trippier. This is the third time this season that he starts in a Premier League game above Trippier, who seems to possibly be wanting out. Obviously missed the original transfer window. We'll see if he goes to Saudi while their window's still open or are on the move in January. But Livramento, for me, is going to be in the running for for England's number one right back for the World Cup and possibly one of the best right backs in the league within the short future. He's just really impressive with his ability of getting out of tight pressure in his own final third very early on in his career. But good game overall to watch, entertaining, a lot of back and forth, a lot of pressure from Spurs, positives for both teams.
Very even game, I think. Fine margins in this one, you know, made the difference. But I just wanted to double down on kind of what you said about Livramento. I think he's going to be really a big time player for them going forward and stepping. And obviously, he's got big shoes to fill stepping into that Kieran Trippier role. But they think really highly of him. And then obviously, Lewis Hall, I think we'll see more of as this season goes on as well.
Yeah,
on the other side.
Well, before we get into like the real blood boiling thing, Kyle, you got anything you want to say about the, you want to get two words in Arsenal wise before I start?
Yeah, yapping? Absolutely. You know what? This is football. The XGs are everything. So clearly whoever got more XGs this game was going to win it. And I think that that shows very largely on this game.
You're talking about the Arsenal Brighton game?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So great segue, because the XGs to this game was Arsenal 2.23 to Brighton 2.24. Now, in the first half of the game, Arsenal had an XG of 9.8 to Brighton's 0.08 XG. So, obviously, no one knows what 0.98.
Is that like a world record in like a game?
Yeah, we got negative XGs in the second half. But I know everyone kind of knows what this is, but they're really, for me, everyone, you know, hang on to the edge of your seat here. This is going to be a long-winded conversation, but there really must be something in the fucking water for these refs when Arsenal play Brighton, because this is the second time we've dropped points due to inconsistent and pure bonehead decisions on the pitch from officials. The first, of course, everyone knows right off the top of their noggin, was against them home in 2022 when the refs overturned an on-field decision of a goal by Martinelli because they believed that they had x-ray vision and assumed that Martinelli was offsides by you know what type of hair. This was in the 45th minute, right before halftime. That would have tied the game 1-1, and we went on to lose that one 1-2. Regardless, this game was about one-sided as it gets in the first half. Like Sean, you and I were talking earlier, Arsenal seems to always start off strong and stifle teams right off the get-go, so put a lot of pressure. Always looked like the better team right off the bat, which is great. And like I said before, Arsenal outmatched Brighton every aspect of the game: momentum, control, XGs from open end set plays, shots 6-3 with 5 of ours on target to Brighton 0. So if the game continued to go this way, it was looking kind of rough for the Gulls. Kai Havertz put us up early or late in the first half around the 38-minute mark from a great pass from Saka, who just bodied someone double his size like it was nothing and gave a nice like open pass over to Kai Havertz, who did a nice dink over the keeper, putting us up 1-0, which also marks Kai passing Mesut Ozil on the most goals by a German player in the EPL tally scoreboard with 34, which is 10 behind, of course, the living legend himself, the returning captain with 44 of Inkay Gundogan. So really good company there, just 10 more and he can take the top spot, which I think he'll be able to achieve his time at Arsenal. But then, of course, all things bad hit the fan at halftime. I can only imagine that this was the conversation that Chris Kavanaugh had. He received a call straight from the PGMLO, or whatever you want to call their shit abbreviation. And it said that Arsenal are going to pull away with this. And I'm quoting this. I have audio footage of this, right? So Arsenal are going to pull away with this one. Do something about it, Chris. Which then Chris replied, don't you worry. I was already planning on it because I'm a dirty Man City fan and I'm going to issue Declan Rice a second yellow card for time wasting in the 49th minute. So that was actual footage essentially that I quoted there from the locker room for the referees. To me, this is a horrible call for any time, any game, any time situation, a horrible decision by a very veteran referee for handing out a second yellow card to a red for something that hadn't been called or given a yellow card for the entirety of the game already. And this is still very early on in the second half. This is 4 minutes into the second half. You know, we'll go through the yes and no's real quick, right? Did Declan Rice tip the ball away? Yes. Is that a yellow card offense for time wasting? Technically, yes. Would the free kick have been allowed to play if Declan didn't touch the ball? No, it wasn't set and it was still in motion. Did Chris ignore a even worse offensive, more critical possession, you know, delay on the first half when he didn't card João Pedro for launching a clearly out of ball back into play to delay an Arsenal restart in Brighton's own half? Yes. So like, how can you tell me in good consciousness that you're going to hand out a red card for Declan Rice, but you're not going to call anything against João Pedro in the first half? I'm not arguing that it was a bonehead move by Declan Rice as well. You know, you're on a yellow, you should be doing better, but you can't. There's a saying in baseball, right? You know, after a couple pitches of after an inning or so, you know, the umpire's plate size, right? You might have a ball that's a little bit outside the strike zone, but he's going to be calling it strikes. We seem to never know the plate size for these referees. You can't not select to give a player a yellow card in the beginning of the game for doing something worse, and then for something even lighter, giving a yellow card, which is now eliminating a player from a game and the next game. To me, it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace.
Listen, I totally understand that it's a soft call. I think the João Pedro one, I understand where you're coming from, but it's not the same thing. He was attempting to keep it a play. Yeah, he boots it down the line. I get it. The Declan Rice one, though, I have seen stuff like that called the yellow. Like, yes, I know some Arsenal fan went back and watched like every game in the last 300 years to see if like a guy got a yellow for kicking the ball away. But this was an initiative they put in place last year. Is it a silly way to get a yellow card? 100%. Is it soft to send somebody off for that? 100%. But by the letter of the law, yeah, it's a red card. I agree with you. I think it's soft. I think it's stupid. But there's also some responsibility on Rice. You have to be upset with him because he knew what he was doing. He was trying to be cheeky about it, and he got caught. So I think there's that piece of it. And then does it change the game? 100%. As said, Arsenal dominated that first half. I the only thing I can compare it to was when Liverpool visited Arsenal last year at the Emirates. And I think that they didn't even get a shot in the first half. The goal they scored went in, I think, off Saliba or off Gabriel. It was like a Luis Diaz run. But otherwise, Brighton couldn't play out of their own half in the first half, just swarming them from a press standpoint. But is it Chris Kavanaugh's fault that Saliba and Gabriel get split by a pass from 50 yards out by Lewis Dunk?
Thomas Partey doesn't track back on Pedro. No, there's a thousand different ways to slice or dice a game ending the way it does. But you tell me, like, at a 49th minute of the game, you're going to double yellow Declan Rice and change the entirety, shape, form, whatever you want to call it. 9 minutes after that red card, they score. I mean, I knew it was coming. There's no way you're going to let Brighton or hold Brighton off from not scoring. I mean, they went on to have 19 shots in the second half. In the second half. And they still only managed to score one. So, I mean, bright side-wise, Arsenal, 10 men, that they can hold their own. We almost won it twice, you know, in that second half with runs from Kai or a quick up-the-pace turn for Saka. If Odegaard and Saka had maybe better final third finishes or passes in that second half, we would have won 2-1. But, yeah. I mean, to me, just fucking João Pedro was 5 yards out of bounds. He launches it. You're not going to call that. You can't. I mean, you look at Arteta's face when Declan Rice is walking past him. Arteta knows he fucking shouldn't have done it. You know, it was dumb. But like that, to me, you look at Arsenal's, you got to look at big picture, right? Like Arsenal's fucking schedule in this beginning is difficult. And the Brighton home is a game that we should win. And it's against a tough team. And we're in a very tough stretch. We have Spurs and City next. So now you're going to take 2 points away from Arsenal, go away to the North London Derby without Declan Rice. To me, it's just fucking fishy and disgusting. To me.
I mean, there's got to be a, like you said already, I don't have to touch upon again. He did it, it's a foul, whatever. But there's got to be some sort of first offense on a yellow. Go. The ref should talk to the captain, let him know if you do that shit again, he's being sent off. Like there should be, I personally think, if you're on a yellow for something of that nature, a warning. Like, hey, this is your chance. Here's your orange card.
He got a yellow for a legitimate yellow for stopping the play in the first half. So it wasn't the same offense twice.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm saying just the general offense of
kicking
the ball away should be, if you're on a yellow, an orange card. A straight warning, do that shit when you're off. But if you're not on a yellow, like Jao Pedro, it's a yellow every time.
Yeah, like this scenario is not 1 + 1 = 2. Like this is not like you did that, you did this. This is a red. There's like other factors in this one that really should have. And you look at a lot of pundits' responses. They say the same thing we're saying: stupid fucking act by Declan Rice. But have some common sense from a very, you know, very veteran referee that is Chris. And they're like, you just go over, you talk about the situation. One, again, the ball was rolling, so it's not a free kick. It would be called back anyway. Two, fucking Brighton player Veltman fucking just takes out Rice's kneecap. Like that's a situation. It wasn't anything.
Rule to the Premier League where only a captain can talk to the ref now.
That's always been the rule.
Like you just got to go to the captain. Like, listen, or the referee needs to talk to the captain. Tell him you got to get your team in check.
Yeah. That it should have been handled differently. But whatever. We could go back and forth all fucking day.
So James, do you think it was deserved or what? Like that's the big question.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Arsenal should have Declan Rice for the North London Derby. There should be some form of appeal. But I looked it up. The only way that you can appeal a yellow card like this into a red is a case of mistaken identity. So if he received this, that's literally what it is. If Declan Rice wasn't the one who committed the foul but got the yellow card,
we could
overturn that. But that's fucking obvious. Like,
I'm glad we have that in place.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Deck. Like exactly. I thought you were Thomas Partey. Like what are you fucking like what? Whatever. Fuck yeah. But on the other spectrum of entertainment, was the Man U Liverpool game, and I'll let Sean, why don't you fucking take this one and Kyle, your two thoughts on it as well. But Sean, lead us into glory over here.
Well, actually, you know what? I wanted to throw it back to Kyle first because I think he should issue an apology to the listeners. Kyle, you want to apologize?
I will apologize to Ian Johnson and him alone. That was my bad. I may or may not have fucked Casemiro real hard last night. World class Cas, you know, let him have it. That's my bad. Yep.
Yep. So if you, I think there's the soccer gods exist somewhere, and there's some karma for that. Like, I'm pretty sure James called Jorginho world class, and then he had that terrible turnover against Spurs and ended up in the back of Arsenal's net not that long after. You got to be selective about who you use that term about, or it'll blow up in your face. But he had two turnovers early in the game that led to Liverpool's first half tallies. But overall, I just think my takeaway was just, Liverpool's press was top notch in this game. It's something that, you know, we come to know and identify with Jurgen Klopp's teams, but I think Liverpool in this game were phenomenal, and it, specifically for setting traps and directing players, to different areas of the pitch where they were kind of isolated and either had to hoof the ball up pitch for an aerial duel with Van Dijk and Konate that United aren't going to win, or just kind of giving the ball away in the middle of the pitch, where Ryan Gravenberch, who was my next talking point, was phenomenal in this game at stepping up, you know, intercepting a pass and then springing the other way. And not even with his passing, but actually with his dribbling, like just picking the ball up and running directly at defenders, opening up area in the wide areas, for guys like Diaz and Salah to cook. And cook, they did 2 assists and a goal for Salah, 2 goals for Diaz, who I definitely owe an apology to. I don't think I've bad mathed him on the pod, but I definitely have to James.
Oh yeah,
over text. Like, I thought he was super wasteful last year, and it was a big reason why we dropped points in multiple different games. Obviously, he had a lot going on personally as well. His dad got kidnapped by the Colombian cartels, so I mean, yeah, I guess small. That could have been a bit more understanding.
But you should be able to push through that shit as a professional player.
Yeah, come on, man. Batten down the hatches. But no, I mean, he had two in this game, two in the first half. And I think the game obviously opened up pretty early on. I think United had some good chances early and came out. Obviously, you know, when you're playing at Old Trafford in a derby game, you're going to have the crowd behind you. They're all amped up. They came out first 5-10 minutes. I was a little bit worried. And then Liverpool had a disallowed goal that was, again, created by Gravenberch picking up the ball and running with it. But kind of after that moment, I felt really confident, like, oh, we're going to score in this game. We're going to get other opportunities to put one away. And we did. Two goals from Diaz before the halftime whistle, a goal from Salah late to ice the game. And just wanted to read this stat because I think it's just absolute lunacy. The most goals scored at Old Trafford since January 24th of 2021. Marcus Rashford is in first place with 31. Bruno not far behind at 29. Cristiano Ronaldo in third. Coming up in fourth is Scott McTominay, the recently departed Scott McTominay to Napoli, with 13. And then Mohamed Salah is number five, most highest top goal scorer at Manchester United.
That's awesome.
Or at Old Trafford, excuse me.
Yeah.
Like, that's insane. He's approaching the Luis Suarez versus Norwich levels of domination, but he's doing it against Liverpool's biggest rival. Like, I can't overstate how impressive that is and how important it is. You know, the results in these games and other games that he's dragged them through, but he's phenomenal. He came out after the game and basically said, like, I want to stay here. If they want to extend my contracts, I'm ready to sign. So he kind of put it in FSG's court, which I thought was awesome. But I mean, he's still the benchmark for attacking play in this league, especially on the wings.
Yeah. He's phenomenal. Going on that, just to bolster down on Salah, that's his seventh consecutive goal against Man U in consecutive games, which is basically the bane of Ten Hag's existence at this point. I don't know if Ten Hag ever played Liverpool and had a solid goal in his face.
Yep. Yeah, he hasn't. He has not. Which is wild. And Mo Salah, he's 32 years old. Single-handedly won my fantasy league this year on all three leagues that I have. So thank you, Salah, for listening to the podcast and also supporting me in my endeavors. But great player, will go down as the Premier League's greatest, and even one of the greatest, and even considering like the career he's had, right? You know, starting off nowhere, then going to Chelsea, Fiorentina, Chelsea again, Roma, Liverpool, like great player all around. I think Sean, you nailed it. I have one question. The resurgence of Gravenberch, is this because it's a Dutch to Dutch connection with Slot?
It might be. It was actually pretty funny doing it against his old teacher in Erik ten Hag, who gave him his opportunity at Ajax. I really, again, Gravenberch has been phenomenal in all three games so far this season. Obviously Liverpool were linked and have been linked to sixes for the last, basically since Fabinho and Henderson left, so 14 months ago or something like that. They went after Zubimendi. That fell through. He rejected them. Screw him. I hate Real Sociedad. Fuck the San Sebastian Mountains. All right, continuing on. He stepped into this six role, which he didn't play at all last year, and looked right at home. I think he's, again, I have to give him a shout out because it was by far the biggest question mark about Liverpool going into this season. And there's nothing, yep, no cause for concern that I've seen through three matches so far from him. So he deserves a hat tip.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think we'll see more develop from Liverpool squad. Obviously right now they have, other than Manchester United, which is at away, a very difficult place to go. We'll see what actual hard hurdles, Man U fans, that they'll be able to face earlier in the season, especially with Champions League coming on with a thinner squad. And then, you know, the backup's young as well, but I have nowhere to talk about thin squads, obviously, with Arsenal now being the smallest. But why don't we take a break here? We're going to go into our music. Kyle will lead off the bat again with Rapid Kicks, and we'll get into our EPL State of Mind Fantasy League update for everybody. So don't go very far.
And along with the great games, we have just some good games, because this weekend was all in all, phenomenal to watch. And I got to start us off with Nottingham Forest. I mean, these guys are starting in the top 10. They're undefeated through three. Nottingham Forest. That's a name that we dropped 2 years ago. Is who the fuck are these guys? So, I mean, they're in the top 10 now. They've only scored three goals to get there. They've won 1-0, tied 1-1 twice. They're going to start playing some real opponents, such as Anfield and Liverpool this week at Anfield. They need to start scoring more. That's just the bottom line. You cannot remain in the top 10 if you're scoring one goal per game. So, you know, good on them. I think they're a team to watch for now just for fun. I think they're going to have a nice little anywhere from 14th to 7th run throughout the season. But good stuff out of Nottingham. Now, better stuff out of Manchester City. This was glorious to watch. As Sean and James like to write, fuck off Haaland is now back with back-to-back hat-tricks as they steamroll a 1-3 win over West Ham. The XGs in this game were 3.43 to 0.79, and it looked it. The only goal they got, I mean, you talk about an against-the-run-of-play goal. That is the definition of it. I mean, they're down 1-0. They're running up the side. It is a hopeful cross to a box that has four Man City guys and one West Ham guy not even in a good position. And our main man just smacks the shit out of it straight into our net. And, I mean, you can even see him on the ground. He just stands up. He's like, man, fuck. What am I going to do?
What was worse, the Dan Byrne own goal this weekend or...
Dan Byrne's own goal was heroic, if nothing else. That ball was 104 miles an hour into the top of the net. But, yeah, as far as West Ham are concerned, 0.79 XGs, only Leicester and Ipswich recorded lower XGs this weekend. So you're going to have to do a lot better if you're a team like West Ham who can genuinely fight for European football in this league. And, I mean, City was the number one XG this week, which is, you know, where you got to be if you want to be number one. Erling Haaland secured his 8th hat-trick in 69 games. I don't think we need to go that deep into this. We talked about it last week, how the insanity is going on right now. So we'll check back in about 3 weeks when he's up to 10 hat-tricks. I did want to shout out Kudus. He's the man. Every single time without fail that West Ham attacked and looked threatening, it was him. His name on the ball, his name finding the space. He was dribbling our players. He was stealing the ball from us. It was just, I wish he was in light blue. Genuinely, that player is unbelievable on that team. And a little shout out is going to go to Jack Grealish. He looked great. He might not have many accolades from the game, but he was the hardest worker on City. Hands down, he was the focal point. And Sean said it last week. Physicality is crazy important. Being able to body off people and run through the center, run through the spine of the field with the ball at your feet is humongous. And a player like Jack Grealish is trying to take it on, and he's successfully dribbling through. It's really nice to see right now. KDB, he's just doing his thing. He hit the post off of a rocket shot. Awesome. He should have had two, to be honest. And the only other point was Ederson. He made a save in the 93rd minute in stoppage time that I thought was the best save of the season so far. Oh, diving to the left, fingertip save off a curler into the post and out of bounds. Just world class. Nope, not saying that. from Ederson. But yeah, I mean, do you guys have anything else from the game?
No, I think that's pretty much it. We definitely, during the Man U Liverpool review, I missed the first like 2 minutes on it. I don't know how much shit you gave Casemiro. I know you apologize, but again, world-class curse, Kyle. Way to stare away from that one. Sean, keep it rolling, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, would it really be an episode of EPL State of Mind without me mentioning Herbero Chiesa? Probably not.
Nope.
He scored a fantastic outside-of-the-box curler that got Crystal Palace their first point of the season, and they do it against pretty quality opposition, Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. The first goal was set up by Cole Palmer to Nico Jackson, who's scored at a pretty prolific rate for a guy who misses a ton of big chances. But yeah, 1-1 there. And then also going across, well, not across London, but Ipswich and Fulham, first points of the season for the Tractor Boys with an outrageous strike by Liam Delap. If you haven't seen it, Kyle's boy, Leif Davis, sprung the counterattack up to Delap, who moved over from the Man City Academy. We talked about him on the preview. Just an absolute missile of the piss variety. So, big one there from Delap and a really good point for them. But I think that kind of concludes us in terms of the rapid kicks, and let's move over to the EPL State of Mind Fantasy League.
I know every week now everyone's going to be on the edge of their seats for this update. We're three games in.
Everything sucks.
Well, that's because we'll get into it of our internal rankings. But the league is off to a blistering start. We already have, or still have rather, 10 remaining perfect starts at 3-0. And we have the honor of having one of them among us, and that is Sean. Sean, you've gotten to quite a hot start here. Is there a secret to your magnificent mayhem of slot soldiers?
Yeah, play Mo Salah. Captain Mo Salah. That's the strategy. That's it. Mo Salah and Cole Palmer. I'm going to have to get them chiropractic appointments because they are just dragging my team, carrying my team with absolute class, top class. They're just dragging guys like Morgan Gibbs-White, Matheus Cunha over the line after just despicable performances so far from them. But yeah, this has been really fun so far. Good start for the lads. Kyle sitting at 0-3.
You know what? I have Salah and Palmer, and I'm still.
You just choose not to. Yeah, you choose the captain Palmer.
I have to say this
against Manchester United, dude. That's you deserve to lose.
I forgot to set captains. We're gonna have to do better. but yeah, it's, look for me at the 5-3 mark.
We're gonna have quite a run for him. Good. Yeah, if you haven't found out by now, the strategy is you have to captain Haaland or you have to captain Mo Salah every week. That's 101 for this now.
Right.
But what is the next insight that Sean, I said last week, I said look into Chelsea's, not just because of this weekend, I said look into Chelsea's attacking force. Madueke looked good over the weekend. Palmer got an assist. Nicholas and Jackson got a goal. So if you did that to an extent, you should have had at least a couple extra bonus points there. But Sean, you take the cake this week with the player or strategy to look forward to next week. What you have here?
Yeah, I have a guy that I'm really high on, and I've talked about him in a non-fantasy context, is Brian Mbeumo from Brentford. I think he's been their best player for a bit now. He's up to 3 goals and an assist on the season after his brace against Southampton. He hit double digit in goal contributions for the last 3 seasons. So if you're worried that it's just, you know, a quick purple patch, no, this guy's a baller. He's probably the most underrated player in the league. I may wait a week or two to put him in my lineup. He's got 2 tough away fixtures with Man City and Spurs. But after that, he's got 3 home games, West Ham, Wolves, and Man United. Those are defenses that can be had. So keep an eye on him. I don't know if I would add him this week, but in the near future, he definitely will be lining up for slot soldiers.
Also, I mean, what a guy. I've never seen someone score and be so thankful to the person who passed him the ball. You root for him. It's so hard not to.
He's got heart. He's got a kind heart. But good. Well, that wraps up our rapid kicks, our fantasy league update. Do keep an eye out for next week's episode. We are entering an international break, so no games this weekend. Those return, I believe, the weekend of the 15th. So that's coming back. A lot of intense games for that. You got the North London Derby coming up, but we'll get a little look ahead at next week's episode where we're going to do a brief deadline day summary and finish up part 2 of our preseason predictions and review, or preview rather. So stay tuned with us next week as we try to avoid more depression through an international break, and we'll return to the EPL with the EPL State of Mind podcast. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you then.